The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Maybe this self-defense exception can swallow the rule, can become a loophole that opens the door to simply unconstrained warfare once again under the label of self-defense. But on the other hand, once you have troops on the ground and have partner forces, it is inevitable. And so I think there was, in working through that during this year, there was a growing sort of comfort with normalizing that situation of sort of more regular self-defense strikes. But there was also a recognition that if this was going to be something that was going to be happening routinely rather than, you know, once or twice in a blue moon, it raised increasing pressures on for what the domestic legal authority was for these strikes.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 3rd, 2016. Early this week, the New York Times published a story by Charlie Savage, Eric Schmidt, and Mark Mazzetti, informing us that the Obama administration had once again expanded the scope of the 2001 authorization for the use of military force. Whereas the administration had previously considered the AUMF to cover military action against the Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab only insofar as that action targeted members of Shabaab individually affiliated with Al-Qaeda, the Times story indicated that the AUMF is now being read to apply to Al-Shabaab more broadly. We brought on Charlie Savage and Bobby Chesney to talk with Benjamin Wittes about what this decision means, where it came from, and what it can tell us about counterterror operations at the end of the Obama administration and the beginning of the Trump administration. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 199. Al-Shabaab under the AUMF.
All right, so let's start with Charlie. If you could just give us an overview of this amazing story you guys wrote this week that has been a little bit overshadowed by tweets of the president-elect, but is of abiding interest to Lawfare's readership.
Absolutely. So I co-wrote this story with my colleagues Mark Mazzetti and Eric Schmidt. Mark and Eric had been part of a different trio that wrote a story in early October about escalating military activity in Somalia over the past year. And that story was mainly descriptive from an operational standpoint. More bombs are falling, more, you know, counterterrorism missions are happening, things are heating up in Somalia. And as part of talking to them when they were working on that story and then took about a month to follow up and suss this out, I got very interested in what the legal authority was, or at least what the administration's theory of its legal authority was, and started pulling on strings, and they asked questions as well. And eventually what we figured out was that the executive branch has at long last decided to do something that it had been arguing with itself about whether could or should be done since its first term. And that was to declare Al-Shabaab as a whole, the Islamist militant group in Somalia, a part of or an associated force of Al-Qaeda for the purpose of the 2001 authorization for use of military force against the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks. That is, it's now part of the Al-Qaeda war. And that means they think that they have domestic authority to fight al-Shabaab in Somalia without raising a war powers resolution problem, and perhaps more importantly, that President Trump will have a, without needing to do anything controversial, will inherit a sort of freer hand in terms of legal authority in Somalia if he wants to escalate operations there. And importantly, the administration is not, the Obama administration that is not declaring at this point, and presumably before it leaves office, will not, that Somalia is an area of active hostilities. That is to say that the 2013 drone strike limits that are intended to protect civilians will be rescinded there, and it will be free fire on any al-Shabaab foot soldier at will, as if it were a sort of traditional battlefield zone. But for the purpose of the ever-elastic, always-stretched AUMF, it has been stretched again now to encompass the Shabaab.
So a couple of clarifying questions. The first is, this essentially treats, for the first time, al-Shabaab in general the way we have treated AQAP and ISIS for the past several years. That is, as organizationally either simply part of al-Qaeda as an original matter or associated forces. And the question is it clear to you whether al-Shabaab here is being treated as an associated force of al-Qaeda, of an associated force of AQAP, or an associated force of ISIS?
I do not know the answer to that question. And supposedly the War Powers Resolution semiannual letter to Congress in December that lists American deployments around the world and is also a public document will clarify. I assume that it's going to be an associated force and not part of al-Qaeda. What exactly the theory is, and in particular, what it'll be sort of important to know to the extent they tell us what the facts are that support this. It's easy to see why it's what their motivation would be from a legal perspective to root this in a congressionally authorized authority. But that was a step they hadn't taken for many years, despite some internal pressure to do so. And so one of the things that we couldn't get people to talk about either through the front door or the back door was what has changed, what is it that the intelligence shows about presumably, you know, contacts with other terrorist group leaders and so forth, and internal communications and intent that shows that this is something that is factually justified, even when it was a step they weren't willing to take a few years ago, when the assessment seemed to be that al-Shabaab was a sort of loosely organized, competing set of rival factions, only some of which cared at all about al-Qaeda and its sort of global jihad aspirations, while other parts of it were purely focused on parochial issues like controlling Mogadishu.
So, Bobby, walk us through what the prior, elaborate a little bit on that prior understanding of Shabaab. As I understand it, I think, if I recall, I forget whether it was one of Jay Johnson's speeches, or maybe Attorney General Holder's speech some time back, where they basically said that they have not taken the position at that time that Shabaab was an associated force, but they have looked on an individual basis as to whether individual commanders were sufficiently entwined with the AQAP or al-Qaeda hierarchy to be part of, in a meaningful sense, al-Qaeda. Is that the sum total of the prior position, or is there some more elaborated position with respect to Shabaab institutionally?
Well, that's the sum total of the publicly stated prior position for sure, but I think it's important to emphasize that there are two major moving parts to our use of force in the Somali East Africa area. So first is what you said, and it's the stuff that does get talked about in the past publicly, that is the connection to the AUMF is based on individual ties of particular targets to core al-Qaeda. And there's some sense to that, for after all, you also have al-Qaeda's East African cell or franchise, however you want to think about it, operating in the same region with a lot of the personnel who years back you would primarily categorize, if you had to categorize them organizationally, as al-Qaeda agents or operatives in the region. These are some of the very people who then get involved with the indigenous al-Shabaab collection of organizations and end up in, to some extent, an influential leadership role. So when you have people that fit that bill in the past, when they've been targeted, the government's been very clear that this is based on their specific individual ties to the al-Qaeda network, and consciously going out of their way to say that we are not asserting that al-Shabaab as an organization has crossed that line into being an associated force engaged in hostilities in the relevant way. Now, the thing is, that doesn't describe all the bases on which we've been using force in that area against them. You have an entirely separate path, at least I think it's entirely separate, that amounts to a self-defense argument. And there's a lot of complexities here, but let me try to sketch an overview. You have circumstances in which airstrikes, possibly other forms of force, but certainly airstrikes, have been used, and the justification given has been, in whole or in part, that the individuals targeted or the group targeted posed an imminent threat. And let's pause there and note that in this context, imminent does not mean a layperson's understanding of imminent. It means something more akin to constant or looming or continuing threat with an uncertain timeline. An imminent threat of carrying out an attack either, and that's critical, either on U.S. forces or presumably African Union forces that were supporting in that area. And the best example of this is the substantial attack carried out not that long ago on the Raso camp, where a large number of just graduated Shabaab fighters were targeted in one fell swoop because it was a fleeting window of opportunity, combined with, we are told, intelligence suggesting that once they dispersed, eventually they'd be carrying out attacks either on U.S. forces or the African Union forces. That whole theory is not hinged on the AOMF. That's about force protection and acting preemptively to take out threats both to our own personnel in the region and to others.
So let's unpack some of this. When you say, Charlie, do you have a sense of why this changed now? I mean, what was, as you understand it, inadequate about the prior understanding in which, you know, as Bobby lays out, there's AUMF coverage of a certain set of people and subgroups, and then there's Article 2 self-defense coverage of imminent attack on either U.S. forces or imminent threat to U.S. forces or allied African Union forces. For some reason now, for the first time, that becomes inadequate to support the operations that we're want to do. And I guess I'm curious whether you have any sense of what changed over the past few months that necessitated that change in legal interpretation.
I do. Let me... In trying to explain this coherently, let me sort of start a couple steps before the last couple of months. So, number one, this dispute about what al-Shabaab's status is under the AUMF and whether we are at war effectively only with a handful of guys who are dual-hatted in Somalia with core al-Qaeda, or we are at war with the thousands of low-level militants who make up al-Shabaab, traces back to the first term of the Obama administration and was sort of the subject of fraught internal fights between, in particular, Harold Coe at the State Department, who took the more dovish position, and Jay Johnson at the Pentagon, who took the more hawkish position, but also sort of flipped back and forth over the course of that term. Then in the second term of the Obama administration, both of those guys are out of those roles, of course. But the Obama launches a couple sort of refined counterterrorism strategies that are sort of become his signature. I've learned what I'm doing and right sizing of the war on terror efforts. The first is in 2013, he gives a speech at National Defense University and he issues the presidential policy guidance, which I'm sure any listener to this podcast knows about. We're going to have the bottom line of which is we're going to have much more constraint as a matter of policy in terms of counterterrorism strikes, drone strikes, and otherwise outside of traditional war zones, only striking at when there's a high-level agreement that a target poses a threat to Americans, not just to American interests, and that there's virtual certainty that no civilians will be killed. And then the second part of his second-term counterterrorism strategy is he lays out in 2014 at his West Point speech, and that is that the United States should not be sending its own forces in a heavy-handed way to occupy foreign countries in the Muslim world. We should have a light footprint approach where we build up and work with partner forces on the ground, and we help them both in terms of training and advising and perhaps with air power assistance that only we can offer. And so these two principles are both about sort of constraint and not being heavy-handed and creating situations that are going to lead to blowback. And they, in that sense, they sound aligned. But it turns out, as 2015 turns into 2016, that there were there was an inherent tension between them. The drone strike rules of 2013 were designed against the backdrop of what Yemen counterterrorism strikes, which was the primary non-hot battlefield zone of that time, looked like, where we did not have troops on the ground working with partner forces in any meaningful way. We were sending drones in from bases outside of Yemen. They were taking a well-planned strike, and then they were leaving again. But when you instead have a working with partner forces kind of operation like we now have in Somalia, you've got partners on the ground, and you've got American advisors who are embedded with them at their bases. They are going to attract fire, and they're going to need defending from that fire. And then as the partner forces get built up and start going out on missions, including missions by themselves, which is the whole goal, they are going to get into hairy situations and they're going to need bailing out. And even though they were the instigator of those fights, they're going to need defending as they so they don't get wiped out if they get into something they can't handle. And so what we've seen in the course of 2016 in Somalia, in particular, is an increasing tempo or frequency of these so-called self-defense strikes, either undertaken to defend African Union or Somali government forces with American advisors nearby who are also at risk, or as the year unfolded, we saw a lot of these suddenly in late August, September, Somali government forces were, as they've gotten trained up, increasingly able to go out entirely by themselves on missions, and then still got in trouble and we needed to carry out purely collective self-defense strikes where there was no tie to protecting Americans. So this increasing tempo brought to the surface really started with that March 5 strike that Bobby mentioned where the 150 Shabab militants are killed, and it's like, that doesn't look like an ordinary self-defense strike. And the concern that led to questions in Washington, they hadn't been consulted, it was a purely AFRICOM decision to go forward, and the sort of worry was maybe this self-defense exception to the PPG rules and the sort of very careful limits of when we're going to take airstrikes outside of hot battlefields, maybe this self-defense exception to that can swallow the rule, can become a loophole that opens the door to simply unconstrained warfare once again under the label of self-defense rather than some other label, but that the intent behind the 2013 rules would be gutted. That isn't. But on the other hand, once you have troops on the ground and have partner forces, it is inevitable. And so I think there was, in working through that during this year, there was a growing sort of comfort with normalizing that situation of sort of more regular self-defense strikes. But there was also a recognition that if this was going to be something that was going to be happening routinely rather than, you know, once or twice in a blue moon, it raised increasing pressures on for what the domestic legal authority was for these strikes. It had to be purely Article II Commander-in-Chief authority. If there was no Americans at risk, and if the partner forces were going after just ordinary Shabab guys and not necessarily the handful that had, as individuals, were deemed part of Qaeda as well. This administration had gotten itself into trouble in Libya in 2011 with airstrikes that did not have congressional authorization and questions about the War Powers Resolution and its limits on operations that Congress has not authorized. And I think that a desire to leave counterterrorism policy in regular order without open questions and tensions that were unresolved and problems as they prepared to hand off this responsibility to the next administration, which they, of course, thought was going to be Hillary Clinton, not Donald Trump. But it led to the question of, let's take another look at Shabab. What does it look like today? Who's in charge? You know, a lot of the different leaders of factions have since been killed since the last time they'd taken a really serious look at it. Is there a case to be made that this existing domestic legal authority can be brought to bear on the organization as a whole? And if so, should we now take this step in anticipation that this increased tempo of strikes is going to continue so that the next administration doesn't have to deal with a War Powers Resolution mess as it walks in the door?
All right. So, Charlie, you have put a bunch of big, fat legal issues on the plate, and I'm going to ask Bobby to unpack them a little bit. So one is the question of whether the designation of al-Shabaab as now within the ambit of the AUMF, as opposed to not but individuals in it may be, is that plausible? Based on the public record, Bobby, in your opinion, is that an interpretation that the public record will support, or is that an example of the endless spread of the AUMF well past what the language of it will reasonably bear, or both?
You know, this is something that in a classroom at a law school, we would call a mixed question of law and fact. And the reason that's important is that there's a hard enough question about what are the relevant facts. That is, what does it even mean to talk about al-Shabaab as a single organization, given the factions within it? Who are the current leaders? What exactly are their formal expressions of allegiance? You know, you have a few sub-leaders who have expressed an Islamic State allegiance. There are others who have remained focused on al-Qaeda. Judging from the public record as opposed to having access to the classified information that's relevant, I don't think any of us are in a great position to weigh in on what the right sort of factual state of affairs really is. There's enough in the public record to make it seem like it could be plausible, but the harder part, in a way, isn't really this foggy fact pattern. The harder part is that other piece I mentioned, the legal question, right? So how is this a mixed question of law and fact? Well, it's bound up in some uncertain, what I would describe as almost doctrinal details about what we mean legally when we say that there's an associated force of al-Qaeda engaged in hostilities against the United States. It's frequently been said, and is even said in statute, that there is this idea of an associated force. What is never said in statute or in a public statement by administration officials is anything very granular about what exactly it means for these diffused networks to count as an associated force. And you can imagine a lot of possible variables that might be necessary or sufficient conditions for such status. Is it enough if the person who's the nominal leader of the overall group swears an oath of allegiance, swears bayat to Ayman al-Zawahiri? Is it necessary that there also be some certain quantum of evidence, and note the uncertainty about how much is necessary, some certain quantity of evidence that the group takes direction and is under the control in some meaningful sense of the Al-Qaeda senior leadership? There are a million ways one might slice it. And I'm not suggesting that therefore there ought to be a statute that tries to spell it all out in great detail. But I just want to emphasize, we really don't know, at least I don't know, and other people on the outside don't know, what goes on when there is a meeting, whether it's within the Pentagon or whether it's an interagency meeting, and people are arguing the point back and forth. What are the variables that they think are truly relevant in this sense? Because it is clearly not the case that simply claiming an Al-Qaeda affiliation is enough. That much is clear from the public record. It's supposed to be something much more meaningful than that. But what are the real hallmarks of connection that gets you into the associated force category? And then what degree of orientation towards the United States and external operations is enough? Related to that, the formulation used for bringing someone within the AUMF in this manner is sometimes phrased as engaged in hostilities against the United States or its allies or its coalition partners. It's very unclear to me, at least, how much that latter part functions as an independent basis. In other words, if you had a group that was not at all engaged in hostilities against the United States or external operations against us, but was very much focused on attacking a local proxy force through which we've been acting and supporting, such as either a transitional government in Somalia or African Union forces, if they're clearly an object of attack and we are clearly working by, with, and through them, is that enough? These are all elements of things that we just don't talk about much in the public record.
So this brings me to my second big legal question, which is the vitality of the idea that Charlie just described of Article 2 self-defense by proxy. That is, everybody agrees that if there's an imminent threat to U.S. forces, that justifies, in a force protection context, the use of lethal force. But what Charlie's just described is a series of events over a period of time in which and what you described earlier was a series of events in which we were using lethal force, not under the AUMF, but to protect allied forces, African Union forces, in their war with al-Shabaab that is separate from the AUMF context. And my question is, how accepted is it that in the absence of congressional authorization, that Article 2 self-defense force protection extends not merely to U.S. forces, but also to allied forces in an otherwise unauthorized conflict?
So I think it's actually quite controversial. There's no doubt that there are plenty of people who would resist that interpretation, because there's a question of line drawing there. Given that we do deploy our forces around the world, we work by, with, and through a astonishing number of other allied governments, and indeed governments that aren't on the front list of places that you think of as our allies, it does open the door to an awful lot. In fact, it opens the door to most of what you might want to use force for, at least at a certain level of intensity. So I think it's quite controversial. I do think that if you're looking for prior examples, the Obama administration did something similar, though distinguishable, in the early days of the renewed involvement in Iraq that was precipitated by the surge of the Islamic State. And I'm thinking here about the use of force in defense of third parties, seemingly under color of Article 2, not because we were defending security services or militaries we were supporting, but actually in a straight-up humanitarian fashion at Mount Sinjar and in other examples from the early months. It's been a while now, and we're all used to thinking about the current involvement against the Islamic State as taking place under color of the AUMF, but let's recall that in the early months of the revived involvement, at least through air power, the major argument that was being put forward, it was never early on an AUMF argument. People were still, I think, sorting out whether they thought they could make that case given the Al-Qaeda Islamic State split. What was being cited in the formal government statements was defense type rationale, immediate exigent self-defense in the face of a potential humanitarian catastrophe that was going to, the destruction of a dam, the Mosul Dam, that might then have downstream effects, including threats to U.S. forces, or simply the threat to the persons who were taking refuge at Mount Sinjar.
I see that written a lot, that there was an Article 2 operation, and then it sort of was deemed an AUMF operation later. I'm not sure that that's correct, at least in terms of what the conversation was behind closed doors. I think people were, because they didn't say AUMF in their public statements about Sinjar, commentators of the Lawfare type jumped to the conclusion that it was an Article 2 operation. It has been suggested to me that from the beginning, they had already had this theory and they just weren't ready to publicly unveil it yet. I don't even know what that necessarily means in terms of any sort of substance, but I pointed out that I'm not sure that they flipped theories, at least in their own minds.
That actually makes a lot of sense to me, and I don't doubt it was the case that at least some people internally, insofar as they could have been pressed to make the point, would say, well, I would ultimately hang my hat on 2001 or 2002 AUMFs. But what this highlights is the difference between what we might describe as sort of the theoretical main or best argument that behind closed doors, some version of the interagency lawyer consensus would attach itself to or sign up for, versus what the public-facing, subject to commentators claim seems to be. And it's going to be the latter one in a lot of cases that ends up kind of mattering in the great subsequent game of grasping for precedence, right? Absent a really clear statement either at the time or at least thereafter that shows, in fact, the theory was X, not Y, if the public-facing statements seem to suggest Y, that's what people are going to latch on to. And so when they're looking ahead and saying, well, have we ever used force in a circumstance where it really was just, third-party self-defense, people will think Kosovo, and they won't really care if people back in the 90s said, well, that's not supposed to be a precedent. That's a familiar argument. And I believe very much that they're going to point to the early months of the intervention against the Islamic State, and they'll say, there as well was a period in which the AUMF didn't seem to be front and center, and Article 2 did. Even if at the same moment in time, if you could have pressed the relevant people, they would have said, no, that's at best a supplementary theory. It's primarily statutory.
Okay, so where does this, that's actually a good transition to where this leaves us going forward. We have a new president coming in, one who has both made very bellicose noises about crushing certain terrorist groups, most famously promising to bomb the shit out of ISIS, but has also in many ways expressed a great deal of reticence about involving us in unnecessary wars overseas. And so my question is, what authority and what constraints based on the AUMF does President Obama leave for President Trump?
Well, I'll jump in to take the first crack at saying something interesting in that area. One thing we haven't discussed but that is a larger pattern that this Shabab change fits into is that President Obama set up all these, constraints on his own conduct of the sort of war on terror. But as he has been in his final year of office, there's a number of different ways in which he's been loosening those constraints. So we've been talking about one of them, the sort of shoring up of legal authority for this escalated tempo of strikes at the Shabab in Somalia, and the normalization of routine or semi-routine strikes both in unit and collective self-defense there, outside of the ambit of the PPG, even though the PPG remains in force there. Another is that in July, we think, maybe early August, they quietly deemed the area around Sirte in Libya to be an area of active hostilities. This is a stronghold of the Islamic State, and the U.S. has been carrying out bombings there without obeying the PPG. They just turned the PPG off there, and so that sort of, that demonstrates that the PPG can be turned off. Each time you do it, it makes it easier to turn it off the next time you want to. And in June, as in Afghanistan, where supposedly the armed conflict was over, except obviously it kept going in various ways, there were limits on airstrikes after we pulled out and handed over Parwan and so forth. We were going to carry out strikes only to defend ourselves, obviously, counterterrorism operations targeting the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, or to prevent the Afghan government from suffering a strategic loss at the hands of, say, the Taliban. And in June, a fourth category was quietly added to when it was permissible to carry out airstrikes in Afghanistan, which was to take out people who were preventing the Afghan government from or impeding their ability to carry out their own strategic plans. And so someone, you know, a shadow government in the government in the province of X, competing with the official government, that doesn't necessarily fall into a counterterrorism or self-defense or any sort of category like that. And so in all these different ways, the Obama is handing over a set of constraints that he imposed that have been loosened, and there's more wiggle room than there was before. I think all these things were done, A, because it was thought operationally justified, of course, but also B, with the thought that a Clinton-Cain administration would be coming in, and it would be, if not quite the same personnel, much the same governing philosophy and national security strategy that the Obama people have pursued, to see then what a Trump administration will do with these constraints. Of course, Trump could simply throw out the PPG entirely and open the throttle everywhere, or he might want to continue it, but certainly he'll have more wiggle room to act, not because he changed something, but because Obama did, as he comes into office.
What do you think, Bobby? Are we dealing with a situation here where Obama is leaving Trump fundamentally a legacy of interpretive restraint, or fundamentally a legacy of interpretive empowerment that Trump can then do what he does, what wants to do with?
Well, I think it's a little bit more the latter, but I just don't think he's, I don't think that there is much legacy really at all. There's, as Charlie said, the PPG or the playbook, this is sort of the centerpiece of it, but it's very obvious and no one denies that it's discretionary entirely. It's all policy. And though there is, in theory, some perhaps friction involved in obliging your successor to actually formally ditch it, I just don't think there's even the slightest doubt that one of the first things Trump will do is he will very, with relish, will ditch it. And he'll go out of his way to make sure we know he's ditching it so as to signal that what he'll characterize as sort of a weak predecessor has now been replaced by him, and he will be more aggressive. I don't think he'll be looking very much to try to cite examples of things, whether it's AUMF interpretations or Article II self-defense interpretations. I don't think he's going to care much about whether or not he can draw some cover from his predecessor, although he certainly will be. I mean, I agree that it certainly could do so, because I agree that there is some of that cover there. I just don't think it'll matter much with him. It would have mattered in a different way, I think, if it had been President Hillary Clinton. And then, to a substantial extent, she'd be able to benefit by saying, look, this isn't that different. I'm doing what went on before. And so I think that the idea, it's not that Obama's done things that are going to make it easier for Trump to then do things. Trump would, I think, be doing these things regardless.
Still, it'll shape the conversation, right? And so you know, on the one hand, Trump may not want to say, well, I'm acting just like Obama. He'll quite want to say the opposite, as you portray, just for sort of optics reasons of a new day. But if people want to criticize that, then at least the and Trump won't be the one making it, but the sophisticated conversation surrounding him, either coming from his administration or from sympathetic commentators, will be, well, look, but Obama did this. Aren't you Democratic Party types, if they're the ones, you know, a Senator Kaine in the, you know, back in the Senate, if they're the ones making this argument, they'll say, aren't you stopped from making that because Obama did X and Y and it didn't bother you as much as you're professing to be bothered now when Trump is doing Z, which is like X and Y plus one, but not out of the blue.
Right. No, that's clearly correct on the pages of the blogs and in your articles where all of us are in the space kind of bounce ideas back and forth. Certainly on AUMF interpretations, if and when we get wind, and let me actually digress here to emphasize, this whole conversation is more or less launched because of the great New York Times reporting that reveals the Al-Shabaab decision. Ben and I and Jack and Matt and others have been arguing for a long time. There needs to be a mechanism to ensure there actually is some public knowledge of these associated force decisions. There's, you know, absent really good reporting, there's no particular reason to think that we would know this. Maybe the War Powers Resolution document periodically would drop hints, sometimes explicitly, not likely under the Trump administration to be very explicit. But in any event, when we engage in these debates, there will certainly be, with whatever we next learn about AUMF expansion, there will certainly be some criticism from quarters that, you know, may well not have made that criticism under Obama, but will be more willing to do it under Trump. And there will be those, and I'm sure I'll be among them, who will be pretty quick to say, hold on, you know, if this is really analogous in the abstract to the things Obama did, we have to factor that into the mix. I don't think Trump or National Security Advisor Flynn are going to care much, but it'll matter for our debates. And then the interesting question is, you know, how much are our debates going to matter over the next 4 years? I hope they matter a lot, but I'm worried about it.
Lawfare is beside the point. I would just also say, sort of, not quite in defense of Obama, but just to sort of not make listeners who jump to the wrong conclusion by the tone of the last 5 minutes, that the fact that the PPG remains in place, notwithstanding that self-defense and even collective self-defense strikes are now understood to be part of it, notwithstanding the fact that it got turned off in CERT, it's still a very meaningful document. It is going to be a big deal if and when President Trump jettisons it. It really does seem to have caused a great throttling back in the number of strikes carried out away from conventional war zones since 2013 when it came into place, and probably you know, quite a number of civilians are alive today who would not be alive had it not been the governing protocol, albeit one that was understood as discretionary in policy rather than mandated by law. And so Obama may have, you know, created more wiggle room here or decided to normalize and tolerate more wiggle room there, but it's not like he's handing Trump something where Trump can already, citing the Obama precedents, simply become unrestrained. It will be a big change if and when that happens.
You know, one thing that's worth emphasizing here that you gave a great list earlier, Charlie, of various things that have been changing by way of loosening up. One that's worth mentioning in light of what you just said that we haven't noted before is the recent decision to remove some of the policy-based constraints on targeting al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, which seems to have taken place in recent months. That illustrates an important point, which is not all the policy constraints are in the PPG, right? There are a variety of theater-specific constraints on precisely who we go after and under what circumstances and to what extent, even within a full-fledged zone of active combat operations like Syria. So there are a number of these constraints out there, and the public really has, you know, some glancing familiarity with the PPG. These other things, I think, are basically invisible to the public. And I think a lot of the change that's likely to go on will involve some of the policies that on the outside we don't even really necessarily know all that much about. Related to that, I think it's significant that there's been talk recently about increasing the independence of JSOC in terms of the ability of the regional combatant commanders to have, but not just insight into, but control over what sort of operations may be taking place. And perhaps, though the stories are a little unclear at this stage, perhaps empowering Special Operations Command to play more of that independent operational command role. This is being described as an effort to ensure that the global JSOC efforts against Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State will be more efficient and more effective and less subject to region-specific considerations that particular combatant commanders may have in mind. I think that's a space in which some of these unseen by the public policy constraints may go by the wayside in ways that are very meaningful, and it may or may not really touch on the PPG.
We are going to have to end it there. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please spread the word and promote the podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, and email. Our music is performed by our associated force, Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.